Hi, my name is Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute, and I'm here to ask for your help. The work of TNI is important and cannot be done without financial resources. If you like the work we do, I encourage you to support TNI. You will help us to continue strengthening international social movements with research, reliable information, sound analysis, and constructive proposals that advance progressive, democratic policy change and common solutions to global problems. We need your help to retain a loud and independent voice in this environment. Please go to tni.org and at the top of the page, click Support Us. You can make a one-off donation or sign up as a friend of TNI and pledge a regular contribution that will help us to continue the vital work being done. Thanks a lot.
During the pandemic, the World Health Organization and governments took a back seat and power was centered on corporate interests. Health was viewed not as a right or a necessity, but rather as a product to be marketed and sold. Even in the midst of a global health emergency, companies treated the ill and the vulnerable as consumers and vaccines as commodities, setting prices and production rates that maximize profit. How has this happened, and what, if any, are the alternatives? Harris Gleckman is a senior fellow at the Center for Sustainability and Governance at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and the director of Benchmark Environmental Consulting. He was previously head of the New York office of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. He's here in conversation with Arun Kundanani, who is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, my name's Arun Kundanani, and in this series of interviews, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an era of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this conversation, we talked about the ways that pharmaceutical corporations have been able to marginalize bodies like the World Health Organization in order to control the global response to COVID, and how doing so has enabled them to prioritize their own profits over implementing any kind of adequate response to the global health crisis of COVID. And we talked about how they've been involved in the creation of what are called multi-stakeholder bodies, which have acted as buffers against criticism coming in particular from the Global South. Remember, if you enjoy the video, please like and subscribe, and look out for the next video dropping in about a month. Thank you for joining us today, Harris. We're going to be thinking about how the international response to COVID has been organized. And with the pandemic, you obviously, by the very nature of what we're dealing with, you need some kind of international response that needs to be coordinated at that level. It can't be solved just by national governments working alone, especially when you think about the things like distribution of vaccines. And so the obvious candidate to do that coordination is the World Health Organization, which is part of the United Nations. There's also the World Health Assembly. Can we begin just by learning about what those institutions are, what their mandate is, what they were set up to do?
Each of the international organizations has an intergovernmental body that is the link between the various capitals and the body that makes the decisions about what the secretariat, the staff, should be doing. So the World Health Assembly is the governing body of the World Health Organization. And it is they that should set the guidelines, the principles, the budget, provide the budget for the organization as a whole.
It's funny that most people haven't heard of the World Health Assembly. I hadn't actually heard about it as well. And so how'd you get to be on it?
Your country designates you as the representative. The parallel, which is more heard of, is that the General Assembly is the governing body of the United Nations. And this is the World Health Assembly governs the World Health Organization.
Right. Okay, so that's good to know as a starting point that there is this structure in place that could provide this kind of role on behalf of humanity as a whole, as it were. We're going to be thinking about a study that you have coming out. It may well be out by the time this video is published. It's not out at the time we're speaking right now. That it's going to be published by Friends of the Earth International and Transnational Institute that looks at these issues of global governance, of the response to COVID. And in that, one of the things you're writing about is how powerful the transnational corporations in the pharmaceutical industry have been in shaping the West's response to COVID. The corporations that control the manufacture of the medical supplies that we need for dealing with COVID. So, for example, you talk about Johnson & Johnson had the power to decide to halt its vaccine production when it became more profitable for them to use their production facilities for other products. You mentioned AstraZeneca that overrode Oxford University's prior commitment to the free distribution of the vaccine that it had developed. Moderna refusing to allow its vaccines to be licensed for manufacture in the global South. So I guess the question is, like, how do you explain the power of these corporations, just even in this state, this moment of emergency, when even if you just think about the capitalist system as a whole and its desire to make profit, the economic impact, forget the human impact, the economic impact of COVID would seem to suggest that there'd just be a collective capitalist interest in effectively delivering vaccines to around the world, let alone any other interest. And yet that doesn't seem to have happened. So, these corporations seem to have the power to do whatever they want, even against the interests of other big corporations. Is that right? And if so, how do we explain that?
There's two dynamics at least involved in what you are raising. One is that the pharmaceutical industry and the World Health Organization have been locked in battles for years. Mm-hmm. The issue is, amongst others, is the World Health Organization a global food and drug administration, a global national health body on the level, setting the rules that would govern a global market? And the pharmaceutical industry is clearly not interested in that role. They are also opposing the role of the World Health Organization, defining things like the essential drugs that a country needs. So there's a long-standing tension between the pharmaceutical industry and the World Health Organization. And when it comes to a pandemic crisis, there are different ways in which that kind of conflict comes out. Mm-hmm. And let me share, but there's another side of this. For each individual firm in capitalism and in pharmaceutical industry, there is an internal reason why production is done in such ways, licenses are controlled in such ways. And then there's the externalization of costs to everyone else. Mm-hmm. A pandemic is a public health crisis. So for the firms, they get to decide in practice the extent to which they'll say they're going to do something because it's a pandemic global crisis, or they're going to take decisions driven by the internal advantage of controlling licenses, controlling production, and leave the external things to governments or to the market, or in fact, to individual potential people who are ill to resolve on their own. Right. And so the second part is that the boundary between internal and external benefits and costs for the firm come into a big play when we're addressing a global public crisis of this order.
Right. And so in your study, you've kind of laid out four different ways that we can categorize the way that corporations and also governments have responded to COVID to try and kind of make sense of it. So can you talk us through these kind of four different categories as kind of like framework for thinking about these issues?
The four different ways relate to choices that very powerful actors can take faced with a global new crisis. The first is to say, is that this is an opportunity to expand markets and to expand the power of those who are already powerful. So selling vaccine, providing vaccines for a manufacturer is really selling vaccines and gaining credibility to open new areas of potential future sales to customers of these, in their view, products. They're not health necessities, as people who are ill feel them. They're products to be sold. So the first response is to say, how can that firm benefit from a pandemic of new people, new illnesses that need to provide a product? The second part is about protecting the rules of globalization, the practices of globalization, over the need for health, over the need for the to reflect the current emergencies. So there are rules in the World Health Organization for intellectual patents. What's the importance of relaxing, waiving those rules, as has been requested by over 20 developing countries? The concern is not how do we create the way to waive those rules to deal with a global crisis, but might it be we have to make sure that people don't think we can waive all sorts of other rules for climate, for oceans, and undermine the World Trade Organization. A number of big steps have been taken to protect the framework of globalization in spite of a global pandemic. Another route forward is to create new opportunities for how to grow globalization. And the biggest one in this area is that when companies in the North provide defective products, products which cause harm that are not intended in one way or another, we have a court system for resolving liability issues where we hold them responsible, and the state can bring the case, or individuals or groups of individuals can. The vaccine industry has opened up a new avenue. They've said, we will not even start to negotiate the price and the delivery of vaccines unless the government, who is the buyer, agrees to accept all liability for anything that happened with our vaccine.
Right.
Whether we were involved or not, shift the burden of liability onto governments in the South. This is a new practice for how to build out of the crisis benefits for globalization. And the fourth is that powerful actors can look at the current reality and say, we are going to take actions which are extraordinary because we have an extraordinary crisis in front of us. We will provide money for vaccines around the world, and we'll take that money from other developed country budget lines and not just from the traditional budget line. We will voluntarily provide our license and the knowledge to how to use the license. We will reach out in different ways to recognize that it's a global crisis. So the fourth item is the powerful could take actions in the face of a major global crisis to address the way in which the systemic issues in the society are set aside for the moment in order to address these global crises, this global crisis.
Okay, so that gives us a kind of framework for thinking about this. And one of the things that you've focused on in detail is multi-stakeholder bodies, and so you're one of the things you're pointing to is how central these have become in the kind of global governance of for example, vaccine distribution, but also the kind of way that they enable a kind of impression that we're taking, you know, the necessary action to deal with a global crisis, but that actually that's an illusion. So can you begin just by talking about what is a multi-stakeholder body and in the context of COVID, like what are the interests that drive these bodies and to whom are they accountable?
So as we were discussing, the World Health Organization is governed by representatives of the 192 countries meeting in the World Health Assembly. So in some ways, that would have been the prime way in which this crisis could be managed. Instead, what was created is something called Act A, with different components. The one for vaccine was called COVAX, which is outside the multilateral system, outside the World Health Organization, bringing in industry associations and some scholars and some financing groups who set themselves up to make the decisions which a more democratic, multi-country basis is not doing. Mm-hmm. Sure, the World Health Organization as a staff is represented, but the power within this group is taken away from a body like the World Health Assembly about who gets what price, who gets first use, what are the rules for the building the healthcare system in order to deliver the vaccines. Mm-hmm. These are now all shifted outside to a combination of corporate-led bodies which bring on board those governments, those civil societies, those academics, that the powerful groups inside the multi-stakeholder groups say, we are willing to work with. And so one of the things you need to look at about multi-stakeholder structures, whether it's in healthcare and other areas, is who and what are marginalized from the process of what we have expected and how it is that the countries, and because the World Health Assembly is open to civil society and academics to make statements to them, but COVAX is not. COVAX can decide. We create an advisory group and we decide if we want to listen to it, whatever we want. Mm-hmm. So the switch in power from a state-based decision-making system to one which is more centrally involved in the corporate interests is one of the reasons why multi-stakeholder governance is very risky for the world's health, and for democracy, and for a sense of control over vital things of health, food, housing, education. They are all at risk if they move to those who have a commercial interest as a key element of what decisions are made.
Mm-hmm. So, and these two bodies that you mentioned, Act A and COVAX, are presenting themselves as vehicles for the equitable distribution of vaccines around the world, right? And so, as you say, they're bypassing the mechanisms that actually already exist in multilateral institutions like the WHO, the World Health Assembly, part of the UN. They're bypassing those where there would be not perfect, you know, it's imperfect, but some kind of way of being accountable to peoples of the Global South, in particular through that international body, they're bypassing that. And these multi-stakeholder groups, heavily shaped by corporate interests, and yet claiming to provide for the equitable distribution of vaccines. So what are they actually doing in terms of distribution of vaccines, distribution of medical supplies needed for responding to COVID and all the other kind of resources that would be needed to be distributed in this emergency?
So when the United Nations has a humanitarian relief fund, it says to wealthier countries around the world, we need this amount of resources because we want to reach out to all those who are harmed, whether it's hurricanes, sea level rise. Humanitarian funds aim to benefit all those who are in. Of course, that doesn't happen. It depends on the amount of resources, but that aspiration is there. One difference is that when COVAX was established, they announced that their goal was only 10% of the population in 72 of the world's poorest countries. But their public literature said that, as you were saying, that they're interested in equitable distribution. And so you have a built-in interest in the control of who gets the benefits. And that's really important, because if one country is more or less cooperative to COVAX and the pharmaceutical industry and the vaccine industry, they may get more special attention. Either their markets are potentially larger, they have a history, they are a certain place in the geopolitical spectrum, and to have this decision-making for 10%. I looked at that and I tried to figure out, well, is that their estimate of the national elite in that country that they're trying to protect? Or is that the number of healthcare providers in the country? None of those held, because their aspiration was different than a humanitarian fund that at least publicly reaches out. I want to pick up another piece of that, which is the question of equitable. There is a narrative story that somehow bringing in equitable language makes it the case. But many of the multi-stakeholder groups have discovered the use of language in that fashion and make the claim that they're doing things better around that. And I think that you have that because some people believe in the multi-stakeholder world and advocates, if you have business in, you'll have more efficiency. They'll get the things happening more quickly. And if you read what COVAX has written about their failures in their own terms to even meet their 10% requirement, they're saying the industry is not very efficient. We have problems in this way. We have problems in that way. And the narrative story captivates and takes away control of an issue in very important ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But to be fair to COVAX, one of the big switches is that instead of governments making money available to a humanitarian fund, the money was switched to COVAX. Mm-hmm. So that there was supply of the money to engage in this, and the power of the money also affects the politics and the healthcare of people around the world.
Right, because what you're implying is that these bodies that, you know, most people, even people who are interested in these questions of vaccine apartheid and so on, that most people haven't heard of these bodies, right? And so, and yet they, I mean, what does it mean to control the distribution of vaccines around the world? It means that you have the fate of the, you know, literally the lives of millions of people in your hands, right? So is that right? I mean, essentially these bodies which are basically controlled by corporations and have no accountability in any real democratic way are holding people's lives in their hands and making their death panels, the old kind of right wing accusation against Obamacare, right, was that there would be death panels deciding who could live and who could die. But this is really death panels on a huge scale, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to. The answer is that in pre-pandemic times and for other medical needs, the so-called market decides where it goes. What's the price? What's the flexibility of what this particular pharmaceutical product is claimed to, it can do in the North or in the South? The allocation choices, to use business language, are made within the private sector. Mm-hmm. When you have a public health crisis, you should be bringing in public health people to lead the effort to do that. In the kind of crisis use of multi-stakeholder bodies, key powerful actors say, no, we don't want the health professionals leading on this matter. We want to have our own commercial interest present or financing interest for the other financing multi-stakeholder groups to have a dominant role in that process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the tough language is, as you were saying, death panels. Is it when you listen to what some of the country representatives have said about working with COVAX, is that they've called COVAX and said, we need vaccines. And literally they have said, we've been put on voice machines, voice recorders, and we haven't gotten answers back. Mm-hmm. That's the extent of the use of power to determine health of people in key parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And that is what needs in a pandemic to be recognized as we need to change the operating rules because we have a global crisis, at least in a global crisis to do that.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that you also write about is that obviously this creates a kind of dependency of the global South on the corporations through these multi-stakeholder bodies. So can you explain a bit more about what you're thinking there?
So if you, South Africa and a number of other developing countries, India has an industry which is the largest historical supplier of all other forms of vaccines to other developing countries. Brazil, Mexico, they have a broad scientific capacity. The choice is, under intellectual property rules, is to be able to have access to the knowledge and access to the technologies in order to address these issues. And so what you have is you have these multi-stakeholder bodies, which have some governments, have some corporations and other people, and they create a confusing buffer where all the different actors can say, we want to help you, but the others at the table are not. Or the others at the table haven't, we're trying to convince them on your behalf. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rather than having a structure which sets as its priority what the World Health Organization said for 2000, health for all. The sustainable development goals don't, what they say is we should be moving toward a healthy population. And there is no qualifier provided that the market is happy. That is what, it's that qualifier which is the power to make the difference. And so you have a multi-stakeholder body blurs that process. And you say, who do we complain to? Where do we bring our protests? Yes, you can bring them to places like Davos. And various nurse associations have gone to this year's Davos and said quite dramatically, we need a different set of ways of getting health to the people which we are dealing with. But that's the way you are forced to raise your protests in a different manner in order to get in from multi-stakeholder groups what a health-oriented global market should be supplying around the world.
You mentioned Davos. So the World Economic Forum is meeting there right now. So, and the World Economic Forum has its own COVID action plan as well, right? Can you say a little about that?
Yes. So the World Economic Forum is the intellectual leaders in the business world about calling for multi-stakeholder capitalism. And they are making that case to those in the business world who are saying, we only want to look at shareholders. And Davos is saying that the world has become more complex. We have to recognize that there are real problems in the world. Some of these things which previous models said were external factors, and accommodate them through stakeholder capitalism, where we at least listen to the realities of the world as we build our operating business models. And so Davos is leading, as they have for over a decade in this area, with assertions that this is the way the world commercial business globalization ought to operate. And so quite reasonably, as they have done for hunger and a whole range of other global crises, they have special task forces on COVID. And I looked at the 20-some odd task forces, and yes, they came into the categories that of the kind of ways very powerful bodies can address a crisis. We need to, they have a task force on improved transport networks, which could be used for bringing vaccines. But the idea argument is essentially, is the transport networks are necessary for selling everything.
Right.
They have views about saying, we have to explain how to present our material so that the narrative of globalization stays, that it works. And so those are in the publication that's coming out. We looked at all of the ones and looked at the political economic rationales of the committees in their published terms of reference to explain what it is that Davos is doing. And in essence, what they're doing, which is fair for what their objective is, they're trying to convince people that stakeholder capitalism works, and here's how it could work even in the face of a pandemic. And it doesn't.
Right, right. So you also, in the publication, describe the kind of crisis emerging from COVID as a war on the global South. Can you explain what you mean by describing it in that way?
The scientific community has been very clear that in order to contain a virus of this nature, it has to be contained everywhere because the virus doesn't know geopolitical boundaries. It will continue to mutate wherever there's an area where it can mutate. The history of colonialism or boundaries or whatever, the virus doesn't engage with. So it requires a global response. So if you look at realities of the fourth option of powerful actors choosing to do things to mitigate the effects of the virus on class and gender and other oppressive structures, you could also look at that saying, what if they don't act, but they are in possession of knowledge which says there are consequences from not acting? And the stand back, do nothing approach or minimalized approach means that the powerful recognize that there will be larger scale illnesses and deaths in parts of the global south that will follow from their non-action. And this, in fact, we probably need to be candid with each other and say, you know, we've recognized armed conflicts and hot wars. We recognize that there's a period called cold wars. And in essence, we've now perhaps got silence, in this case, southern wars, where non-action, when the actors who don't act have access to knowledge that says there will be devastation from your not acting, and don't act. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it's a new form of silent warfare, because you can strategically and politically recognize and scientifically recognize that not addressing something that could be addressed has warlike consequences. The number of people in particular areas of the world are not going to be healthy, and some are not going to live. And in some ways, this is true with climate as well. This is true with some other areas where we can look at the evidence and say, really, there's a silent warfare going on, because we knowingly are doing something which, in military terms, we engage in killings by actions. Here we are engaging in killings by choosing not to act. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Harris, can you lay out, roughly like what the alternative might look like here? And you know that you've kind of mentioned a few suggestions along the way, but can you speak a bit more about that?
Yes, I think that the governments at the World Health Organization could take steps to reassert their position in the World Health Assembly, to insist that these issues be brought back into a more democratic decision-making arrangement. I think that there should be standards for declaring health hazards and health emergencies that the World Organization ought to make, not the World Trade Organization. Under current practices, the World Trade Organization members unanimously have to agree to waivers for health-related technologies in this area. Those declarations of emergencies should not be a trade matter, a matter for trade ministers, but should be a matter for health ministers to say, we've now crossed a point that normal rules need to be suspended. I think there are ways in which the price of vaccines and related pharmaceuticals should be set an index to the countries which that are receiving it, given the cost of production, and not set in such a way that there's a 10 or 15% return on investment when particularly you have a global crisis. We need to be able to open our minds that the routine practices of the market need clear exceptions in global crises. And they may need to be discarded altogether, but in the face of pandemics and other climate-related crises, these normal rules should be set aside. There are higher human priorities. And I think that the starting point is to say that the things like the Sustainable Development Goals articulating some of these higher priorities should be the much more determining factor than a decision about what's an internal cost for the firm and what the firm wants to externalize, or how the firm would like or not like global governments to set standards for how they should behave. The priority should be clear as to what we're trying to do. And so that's my. So the narrative part of the story is to take those messages of global health, global climate, and global social goals and say, they are what we're trying to accomplish. What do we have to change in the business world, in the geopolitical world, to get to those results.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Davos, but are there particular locations and venues where movements that are interested in taking up this agenda might focus their efforts over the coming years?
Yes, each of the intergovernmental bodies meets at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, and making the case to them of their loss of authority in global governance and insisting that they reassert their position. Just to give another example of how they could reassert their position and campaigns could be done, is if for any multi-stakeholder group or, in fact, corporate-led group who asserts that they are doing this to implement UN goals like the Sustainable Development Goals, submit their papers to the intergovernmental body to see if they agree that those are what is happening, and not allow the commercial sector, who has the control of the production facilities around the world, to say, oh, yes, we're giving equity, we're meeting these goals. Let's them have a public debate. Does that particular project, that particular multi-stakeholder group, actually delivering against those real goals?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, well, that they should not be allowed to use the, we are acting for the United Nations, we're acting for the World Health Organization, the Food and Agriculture Organization, in their marketing materials.
Thank you, Harris. And what you're saying is so urgent and so crucial. And I do really recommend the report that you've written for Friends of the Earth International and Transnational Institute. It may well be available as this video is published, but if not, soon afterwards. So I would strongly recommend everyone watching this to read that. Next month, I'll be speaking with Sulakshana Nandi on the response to COVID in India. That video will drop on July 20th. So make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel so you get that when it comes out. Thank you very much.
Arun, thank you very much for inviting me to join your series.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Harris Gleckman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Sustainability and Governance at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and the director of Benchmark Environmental Consulting. This episode is part of a monthly series on the securitization of health hosted by Arun Kundanani. Be sure to also check out previous episodes and to look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining today, and see you next time.